Welcome to the Vero Yahad Essene Scripture Forum. Controversial issues? You bet. Straight answers? Of course. Truth? You be the judge. For you're welcome to participate. Shabbat afternoons at 2 p.m. Eastern Time. Log in at www.theyahad.com. See you there. I don't know if you were alive back then, but perhaps you remember the My Lai massacre. I think it was in 68, toward the end of the Vietnamese War, when all us teens were shaking in our boots, waiting to see what the next draft lottery would be. And if you don't remember that, let me tell you how the draft lottery went, because I was in it. They had this on TV. You were assigned a number depending on your birth date and year. So if you were born January 1st, you had number one. January 2nd, number two, and on through the year. And then they would have the lottery for those people that were going to be drafted come on early in the year, maybe at the end of the previous year. Can't remember for sure. And they had a cage, a round cage, like a rotisserie cage. And in there were ping pong balls with numbers on them. And they had a host, like a game show. And the co-host was, of course, a beautiful young woman in a somewhat revealing outfit. And they begin the lottery by flipping the cage around, and all the different balls in there would be spinning, and they would stop it. Then the lady would take out one ball, hand it to the host, and announce the number, 175, for instance. Then if you were a 175, you were the first to go, unless you could find a way out. And of course, a lot of guys our age tried to find a way out. Some of the things that were done were absolutely crazy. Like, you could take a chemical called bromothymol blue, and it caused you to urinate blue and green. And supposedly, if you urinated green, then they wouldn't take you because that was a sign of a bladder infection. So my friends and I, we took a trip to Quebec. We had just a little bit of money and an old junky Rambler, 1963 Rambler, drove up, deciding we were going to check out whether we ought to go to Canada or not. I knew that I would be killed if I went over there. And it was by this time that everyone knew that what they were sending to the front lines were just cannon fodder. About 500 a day were being killed. If you're on the front line, you had a 7-second life expectancy. And through my middle school years, I was a debater, and I debated against the Vietnam War when the sentiment of America was very much for it, because they had been fed so many lies about what was going on there. Primarily then, later on, the head of all operations there, General McNamara, in a tearful confession, confessed on a television special that the war turned out to be all about money and economy, and that he colluded with the President Johnson at that time to keep the war going for that account, because they were trying to create the Great Society, and in order to do that, they needed lots of money, lots of tax. They wanted to keep the war going. Well, my friends and I, we got up to London, Ontario, or almost there, about 100 miles away, and the car blew up. So we're some little town, and we spent the rest of our money to get the car fixed, and that got us the next 100 miles to London, Ontario, where it broke down for good. So we stayed at a friend's rescue mission there and decided to parlay the rest of the stuff that we had with the exception of our camping equipment at a pawn shop. And we bought tickets, round-trip tickets, as far north as we could go. Our journey's end was to be a town up on Lake Powell, Pascalis in Quebec, and the name of the town was Pascalis. We had a reason for picking that town out, but we took the train then from Ontario up through Quebec and on up into Indian country there towards Pascalis through Noranda, Quebec. Stayed one night in Noranda, couldn't find a place to stay, and up there they were murdering Americans that were coming up to supposedly avoid the draft. We were told this by churches that we went by. We wanted to camp out in the backyard of the church until our next train came. Couldn't find any. So we ended up having our best night of all in Quebec in jail as vagrant because we were afraid of getting killed. And so we went to jail and then we went on up the next day to Quebec and the train just kept shorter, getting shorter and shorter and shorter. And we finally came to the Pascalis stop and there was no town there. All there was a little box-like structure beside the railroad track with an old telephone in it from the 1920s with a dry cell battery that had long dried up. And we said, as they stopped the train for us and we got off, where's the town? I said, well, we never been to the town. But this is where the old stop was. We don't stop here anymore. I don't know how you got a ticket here, but you did. So you get out. And so we did get out and we found out from some of the locals that Pascalis had sunk into the earth, that there had been a hollow part of the earth and the whole town had sunk about 30 years before. So there was no town there at all. All that was there was a little bar and restaurant, and it was on the outskirts about 5 miles away. So we took the stuff that we had, a little bit of food and some camping equipment, and hauled it into the jungle there. It's a huge forest up there around this lake. It was off season. There were cottages here and there, not too many. Nobody was there. And that was the beginning of a pretty incredible journey. But yes, the intention was, if we got picked in the lottery, to go up and stay up there. We had a friend that was staying with us at the time. He got picked like number three. He got out of it because he was too short, if you can believe that. But that was only the beginning of the journey. That was in 1970. This massacre happened in 68, I believe, late 68. It was all over the newspaper that several groups of United States military had gone crazy in Vietnam and started shooting up everything they could find, down even going so low as to massacring villages. And several groups of these soldiers, when they came around what was going on, they caught it. They caught this mass evil and they began to fall into it and do the same thing as though it were something outside of them rather than inside. Well, I just wanted to tell you my little story here, and I've got this queued up anytime you want it, Rich.
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay, I'm going to share the screen, share the computer sound. There's Scott Peck, and here we go. You let me know if you can hear it all right.
On the morning of March 16th, 1968, elements of Task Force Barker moved into a small group of hamlets known collectively as My Lai in the Quang Nai province of South Vietnam. It was intended to be a typical search-and-destroy mission. That is, the American troops were searching for Viet Cong soldiers so as to destroy them. Relative to other units operating in Vietnam, the troops of Task Force Barker had been somewhat hastily trained and thrown together. In the previous month, they had achieved no military success. Unable to engage the enemy, they had themselves sustained a number of casualties from mines and booby traps. The province was considered to be a Viet Cong stronghold, one in which the civilians aided and abetted the guerrillas to such a degree that it was often difficult to distinguish the combatants from the non-combatants. Army intelligence had indicated that Viet Cong were being harbored by the villagers of My Lai. The task force expected to find combatants there. On the eve of the operation, there seemed to be a mood of anticipation. The nature of the instructions given to the enlisted men and junior officers that evening by the senior officers was at best ambiguous in regard to the distinction between combatants and non-combatants. Although essentially all elements of Task Force Barker were involved one way or another in the operation, the primary element of ground troops directly involved was C Company. When Charlie Company moved into the hamlets of My Lai, they discovered not a single combatant, none. None of the Vietnamese was armed. No one fired on them. They found only unarmed women, children, and old men. Some of the things that then happened are unclear. What is clear, however, is that the troops of C Company killed at least somewhere between 500 and 600 of those unarmed villagers. The most large-scale killings occurred in the particular hamlet of Milai 4. There, the 1st platoon of Charlie Company, under the command of Lieutenant William L. Calley, Jr., herded villagers into groups of 20 to 40 or more, who were then slaughtered by rifle fire, machine gun fire, or grenades. It is important to remember, however, that substantial numbers of unarmed civilians also were murdered in the other hamlets of Milai that day by the troops of other platoons under the command of other officers. The killing took a long time. It went on throughout the morning. The number of soldiers involved can only be estimated. Perhaps only about 50 actually pulled triggers. Approximately 200 directly witnessed the killings. We might suppose that within the week, at least 500 men in Task Force Barker knew that war crimes had been committed. The failure to report a crime is itself a crime. In the year that followed, no one in Task Force Barker attempted to report the atrocities that had occurred at Milai. The fact that the American public learned about Milai at all was due solely to a letter that Ron Ridenour wrote at the end of March 1969 to several congressmen about the atrocities, more than a year after they had occurred. Ridenour had not himself been a part of Task Force Barker, but had later heard of the atrocities in idle conversation from friends who had been at Milai, and he wrote his letter 3 months after his return to civilian life. In the spring of 1972, I was chairman of a committee of three psychiatrists appointed by the Army Surgeon General at the request of the Chief of Staff of the Army to make recommendations for research that might shed light on the psychological causes of Milai so as to help prevent such atrocities in the future. The research we proposed was rejected by the General Staff of the Army, reportedly on the grounds that it could not be kept secret and might prove embarrassing to the administration, and that, quote, further embarrassment was not desirable at the time, unquote. The rejection of the recommendations of the Committee for Research is symbolic of several issues. One is that any research into the nature of evil is likely to prove embarrassing, not only to those who are the designated subjects of the research, but also to the researchers themselves. If we are to study the nature of human evil, it is doubtful how clearly we will be able to separate them from us. It will most likely be our own natures we are examining. Undoubtedly, this potential for embarrassment is one of the reasons we have thus far failed to develop a psychology of evil. The rejection by the General Staff of our recommendations for research also highlights the fact that in considering the evil at Milai, as in all our other considerations of evil, we suffer from a simple lack of scientific knowledge. Therefore, much of what follows is only speculative. Triggers are pulled by individuals. Orders are given and executed by individuals. In the last analysis, every single human act is ultimately the result of an individual choice. Not one of the individuals who participated in the atrocities in Milai or in their cover-up is blameless. In books 1 and 2, our focus has been on specific individuals whom I have labeled evil and distinguished from the vast majority of other individuals I have designated not evil. Even if we allow that this sharp distinction is somewhat arbitrary, that there is a whole continuum between those who are thoroughly evil and those who are not at all evil, we are left facing a problem. How is it that approximately 500 men, the majority of whom were undoubtedly not evil as individuals, could all have participated in an act as monstrously evil as that at Milai? Clearly, to understand Milai, our focus must not be limited solely to individual evil and individual choice. We are now, therefore, concentrating on the phenomenon of group evil as being somewhat distinct from, although in many respects similar to, the phenomenon of individual evil. For many years, it has seemed to me that human groups tend to behave in much the same ways as human individuals, except at a level that is more primitive and immature than one might expect. Why this is so, why the behavior of groups is strikingly immature, why they are, from a psychological standpoint, less than the sum of their parts, is a question for which there is more than one right answer. One of those is the problem of specialization. Whenever the roles of individuals within a group become specialized, it becomes both possible and easy for the individual to pass the moral book to some other part of the group. In this way, not only does the individual forsake his conscience, but the conscience of the group as a whole can become so fragmented and diluted as to be non-existent. Bearing in mind the psychological immaturity of groups, we shall be examining aspects of both the My Lai crimes, the atrocities themselves, and their cover-up. Although the cover-up may seem less atrocious than the atrocities, they are all part of the same ball of wax. How is it that so many individuals could have participated in such a monstrous evil without any of them being so conscience-stricken as to be compelled to confess? The cover-up was a gigantic group lie. Lying is simultaneously one of the symptoms and one of the causes of evil. It is why this book is entitled People of the Lie, certainly by virtue of their extraordinary communal participation in the cover-up. The men of Task Force Barker were a people of the lie. By the time we are finished, we may even conclude that the American people, at least during those war years, were also a people of the lie. As with any lie, the primary motive of the cover-up was fear. The individuals who had committed the crimes, who had pulled the triggers or given the orders, obviously had reason to fear reporting what they had done. Court-martial awaited them. But I suspect there is another extremely significant reason that the crimes of My Lai went unreported for so long. I offer it purely as conjecture that to a considerable extent, the members of Task Force Barker did not confess their crimes simply because they were not aware that they had committed them. They knew, of course, what they had done, but I suspect that many of them did not even consider it a crime. They did not confess because they did not realize they had anything to confess. How can this be? How can a sane man commit murder and not know he has murdered? How is it that a person who is not basically evil may participate in monstrous evil without the awareness of what he has done? It is this question that will serve as a focal point for the discussion that follows on the relationship between individual and group evil. I believe that anyone who has been in significant chronic pain or prolonged discomfort will recognize that we humans naturally, almost inevitably, tend to regress. Our psychological growth reverses itself. Our maturity is forsaken. Quite rapidly, we become more childish, more primitive. Discomfort is stress. The fact of the matter is that the troops of Task Force Barker were in a chronically stressful situation. They were at the other end of the world from their homes. The food was poor, the insects thick, the heat enervating, the sleeping quarters uncomfortable. Then there was the danger, more stressful because it was so unpredictable. Besides regression, there is another mechanism whereby human beings respond to stress. It is a mechanism of defense. Robert J. Lifton, who studied the survivors of Hiroshima and other disasters, has called it psychic numbing. In a situation in which our emotional feelings are overwhelmingly painful or unpleasant, we have the capacity to anesthetize ourselves. The sight of a single bloody, mangled body horrifies us. But if we see such bodies all around us every day, day after day, the horrible becomes normal and we lose our sense of horror. We no longer truly see the blood or smell the stench or feel its agony. Unconsciously, we have become anesthetized. When it no longer bothers us to see mangled bodies, it will no longer bother us to mangle them ourselves. It is difficult indeed to selectively close our eyes to a certain type of brutality without closing them to all brutality. How can we render ourselves insensitive to brutality except by becoming brutes? I think we can assume, therefore, that after a month in the field with Task Force Barker, a month of poor food, of poor sleep, of seeing comrades killed or maimed, the average soldier was more psychologically immature, primitive, and brutish than he might otherwise have been in a time and place of less stress. In Book 1, I spoke of the relationship between narcissism and evil and said that narcissism is a condition out of which human beings normally mature. We may think of evil, then, as a kind of immaturity. Immature humans are more prone to evil than mature ones. And since we normally regress in the face of stress, can we not say that human beings are more likely to be evil in times of stress than in times of comfort? As we shall see, this is but one of many factors that accounted for the evil at My Lai. Individuals not only routinely regress in times of stress, they also regress in group settings. One aspect of this regression is the phenomenon of dependency on the leader. It is quite remarkable. Most people would rather be followers. More than anything else, it is probably a matter of laziness. It is simply easy to follow, and much easier to be a follower than a leader. There is no need to agonize over complex decisions, plan ahead, exercise initiative, risk unpopularity, or exert much courage. The problem is that the individual adult becomes psychologically dependent on the leader, as a child is dependent on its parents. In this way, there is a profound tendency for the average individual to emotionally regress as soon as he becomes a group member. In the military, the dependency of the soldier on his leader is not simply encouraged, it is mandated. By nature of its mission, the military designedly and probably realistically fosters the naturally occurring regressive dependency of individuals within its groups. I have already made note of the fact that patterns of group behavior are remarkably similar to the behavior of an individual. This is because a group is an organism. It tends to function as a single entity. A group of individuals behave as a unit because of what is called group cohesiveness. There are profound forces at work within a group to keep its individual members together and in line. Probably the most powerful of these group cohesive forces is narcissism. In its simplest and most benign form, this is manifested in group pride. As the members feel proud of their group, so the group feels proud of itself. Once again, the military deliberately does more than most organizations to foster pride within its groups. It is no accident that the common term for group pride is a military one, esprit de corps. A less benign but practically universal form of group narcissism is what might be called enemy creation or hatred of the outgroup. Task Force Barker, of course, had a pre-designated enemy, the Viet Cong, but almost inevitably, the specified enemy was generalized to include all Vietnamese. It is common knowledge that the best way to cement group cohesiveness is to ferment the group's hatred of an external enemy. Deficiencies within the group can be easily and painlessly overlooked by focusing attention on the deficiencies or sins of the outgroup. But this use of narcissism is potentially evil. In books 1 and 2, we have extensively examined the ways in which evil individuals will flee self-examination and guilt by blaming and attempting to destroy whatever or whoever highlights their deficiencies. Now we see that the same malignant narcissistic behavior comes naturally to groups. From this, it should be obvious that the failing group is the one likely to behave most evilly. Failure wounds our pride, and it is the wounded animal who is vicious. Group leaders in all places and ages have therefore routinely bolstered group cohesiveness in times of failure by whipping the group's hatred for the enemy. We will remember that at the time of My Lai, the operation of Task Force Barker had been a failure. After more than a month in the field, the enemy had still not been engaged, yet the Americans had slowly and regularly sustained casualties. The enemy body count, however, was zero, failing in its mission, which was to kill in the first place. The group leadership was all the more hungry for blood. Given the circumstances, the hunger had become indiscriminate, and the troops would mindlessly satisfy. I have already mentioned the potential for evil in specialized groups. An important fact to bear in mind about specialization is that it is seldom either accidental or random. It is usually highly selective. Task Force Barker was a specialized group existing solely for the purpose of conducting search and destroy missions in Quang Nai Province. What the listener may not realize, however, is the large amount of selection and self-selection involved in the creation of that group. Task Force Barker consisted either of career military personnel who had deliberately chosen the combat arms or young grunts who had done likewise.
You may contact us at Jackson Snyder Presents at this email address, veroyahad@gmail.com. That is veroyahad@gmail.com. And let me remind you, you are listening to Jackson Snyder Presents with your host tonight, Bogdan G. Shrumkov. Thank you for listening. We'll be right back. Jackson Snyder Present is back. Join us now for more of this interesting discussion.
The case of a prototypical individual may serve to illustrate some aspects of the relationship between American society in 1968, its military, and the subgroup of the military fighting in Vietnam. Let us call this prototypical individual Larry and set the place of his origin as Iowa. The oldest of six children, born to an alcoholic farmhand and his tired wife, Larry was clearly a hellraiser from the time he hit puberty. Dropping out of high school as soon as he turned 16, in 1965, Larry vaguely supported himself with a series of odd jobs that proved inadequate to pay for his car insurance, gas, and heavy drinking lifestyle. In November 1966, he was apprehended attempting to rob a local gas station. The community had no desire to increase the state prison population or its tax burden, so the county judge told Larry he had two choices, to join the army or go to jail. Larry enlisted for Vietnam because he had heard that the girls were easy there, and besides, shooting up some gooks might be kind of fun. I do not mean to imply that Task Force Barker was made up of petty criminals like Larry, but it was not any random group of men. It was highly specialized, not only in its mission, but also in its unique composition. The specialized human composition of Task Force Barker and countless other human groups raises three significant issues. First is the question of the flexibility that can be expected of specialized human beings. Charlie Company was a specialized group of killers. The individuals in it had, for one reason or another, gravitated toward the killing role, as well as being deliberately seduced into that role by the system. In addition, we trained them for the role and provided them with the weapons to perform it. Is it surprising, then, given a host of other contributory circumstances, that they killed indiscriminately, or that they apparently failed to experience great guilt over what we had led them to do? Is it realistic to encourage and manipulate human beings into specialized groups and simultaneously expect them, without any significant training, to maintain a breadth of vision much beyond their specialty? A second issue is the subtle but definite scapegoating involved. The prototypical Larry was a scapegoat. When his community pushed him into the army, it was not attempting to deal with the human social problem he presented. It was simply getting rid of the problem. The people purified their own community by dumping the dirt on the military, sacrificing Larry to the god of war. And they scapegoated the military as well. It is, of course, one of the unwritten functions of the military to serve as a dumping group for some of the more misbegotten of America's youth, a sort of national reform school. But the fact that this system works rather smoothly, and not always for ill, should not blind us to the scapegoating nature of the process. By then seducing him into Vietnam, the army, of course, further scapegoated Larry. On the one hand, it makes a definite kind of social logic. Why shouldn't those individuals like Larry, who are troublemakers and misfits, be the most appropriate candidates for cannon fodder? If someone has to be killed, why not let it be one of apparent little social value? But the decision to kill was not Larry's, nor Lieutenant County's, nor his superior officer, Captain Medina's, nor Lieutenant Colonel Barker's. It was America's decision. For whatever reason, America decided that there would be killing, and insofar as these men killed, they were all doing America's bidding. They may have seemed dirtier and less noble than the average American, but the fact is that we Americans, as a society, deliberately chose and employed them to do our killing, our dirty work, for us. In this sense, they were all our scapegoats. And this is the third issue we must look at. It is not only possible, but easy, and even natural, for a large group to commit evil without emotional involvement simply by turning loose its specialists. It happened in Vietnam. It happened in Nazi Germany. I am afraid it will happen again. What we need to learn is that whenever we create specialty groups, We are creating the dangerous possibility that our right hand will not know what our left is doing. Our society developed and currently maintains the policy of an all-volunteer military. Abandoning the concept of the citizen soldier in favor of the mercenary, we have placed ourselves in grave jeopardy. The military will inevitably become not only specialized in its function, but increasingly specialized in its psychology. A draft, involuntary service, is the only thing that can keep our military sane. I have spoken of the relationship between a specialized small task force Barker and the larger group that spawns it. Now let us turn to the large group itself. In this instance, the United States military.
I want to let you in on a little secret. Please do not tell anyone about my secret, because it is very limited to just a few fortunate people. But here it is. The Vero Essien Yard is sponsoring a new event, Wilderness Boot Camp, just for you. With tabernacling and a feast of Pentecost, according to the Zadokite calendar. Experience a slice of life from a journey of the historical Essenes, June 6th through 10th, 2019. 4 nights, 5 days. You know, Pentecost was the main feast for Essenes, Nazarenes, and Enochians. Pentecost in 2019 is the 9th of June, again according to the Zadokite calendar. This is a very inexpensive event, and it is also semi-primitive. So why not check your bug-out bag right now and see if you have the things you need to bug out the Vero Essien Yahad Wilderness Bootcamp and Pentecost. June 6th through 10th, 2019, lodging, 4 nights, only $60. Yes, you heard me, $60. Where? In the very popular Harrison Bay State Park near Chattanooga, Tennessee. And one feature that we're going to try this year for boot camp is spelunking. Yes, there are beautiful caves nearby. We will try to re-experience the life and livelihood of the earliest wilderness camps. Of course, we're going to have electric, and we're going to have water in bathrooms. What we can't do without those these days. But why don't you go right now and check out the details at www.essene.faith. Again, www.essene.faith. Or contact me, your brother Bogdan Shlumkov, at theveroyahad at gmail.com. Am I going to be there? No. I'm too old, and besides, Medicare won't pay for it. But you can be there, but again, very limited number can come. Check us out. Essene.faith. Can I have a big amen?
In this instance, the United States military. My purpose here is not to present a fully balanced picture of the military, but to examine one of the military's failures as an example of the phenomenon of group evil. Consequently, it is necessary to focus on the less savory aspects of the military mind, or soul. In a time of sustained peace, the military man is disregarded, at best considered by his country as a necessary evil, and more often as a rather pathetic parasite on the body politic. In a time of war, however, he suddenly becomes needed again, filling a role not only regarded as useful, but absolutely essential by his society. The drudge becomes the hero. It is inevitable, then, that the ordinary career military man, unconsciously if not consciously, desires, longs for war. War is his fulfillment, and in 1968, it was the military man that had to bear the full brunt of the exquisite pain of America's humiliation in Vietnam. It was the unvanquished military that was failing in the performance of its very raison d'etre. The pride of the military was badly wounded. Again and again, we have noted the birth of evil from a condition of threatened narcissism. For the military, the conditions were ripe for evil. Just as the highly narcissistic, evil individual will strike out to destroy whoever challenges his or her self-image of perfection, so by late 1967, the American military organization, highly narcissistic, as all groups tend to be, began to strike out with uncharacteristic viciousness and deceit against the Vietnamese people, who were wreaking such havoc on its self-esteem. Although the atrocity at My Lai was undoubtedly unique in magnitude, I have every reason to suspect that smaller atrocities were being committed by American troops throughout Vietnam at the time. I think we can safely say that My Lai occurred in the context of an atmosphere of atrociousness and evil that was pervasive not only in Task Force Barker, but throughout the entirety of the American presence in Vietnam. While the military may have been crashing around in Vietnam like a crazed bull, it did not get there of its own accord. The mindless beast was sent there and let loose by the United States government acting on behalf of the American people. Our military involvement in Vietnam began in the period between 1954 and 1956, when the idea of a monolithic communist menace seemed realistic. A dozen years later, it was no longer realistic. Yet at precisely the time when it had ceased to be realistic, when we should have been readjusting our strategy and withdrawing from Vietnam, we began to seriously escalate our military involvement there in defense of obsolescent attitudes. Why? Why, beginning around 1964, did America's behavior in Vietnam become increasingly unrealistic and inappropriate? There are two reasons: laziness and, once again, narcissism. I think we may properly regard the men who governed America at the time of My Lai, the Johnson administration, as lazy and self-satisfied. They, like most ordinary individuals, had little taste for intellectual confusion, nor for the effort involved in maintaining a, quote, posture of constant self-doubt and criticism, unquote. They assumed that the attitudes they had developed toward the monolithic communist menace during the preceding two decades were still the right attitudes, although the evidence was obviously mounting to throw their attitudes into question. They ignored it. To do otherwise would have placed them in the painful and difficult position of having to rethink their attitudes. They did not take up the work required. It was easier to proceed blindly, as if nothing had changed. Thus far, we have been focusing on the laziness involved in clinging to attitudes that have become obsolete. Let us also examine the narcissism. We are our attitudes. If someone criticizes an attitude of mine, I feel he or she is criticizing me. If one of my opinions is proved wrong, then I have been proved wrong. My self-image of perfection has been shattered. Individuals and nations cling to obsolete and outworn ideas, not simply because it requires work to change them, but also because in their narcissism, they cannot imagine that their ideas and views could be wrong. When this happens, the nation, instead of readjusting in the light of the evidence, sets about attempting to destroy the evidence. This was what America was up to in the 1960s. The situation in Vietnam presented us with evidence of the fallibility of our worldview and the limits of our potency. So, rather than rethinking it, we set about to destroy the situation in Vietnam, and all of Vietnam with it, if necessary, which was evil. Evil has already been defined most simply as the use of political power to destroy others for the purpose of defending or preserving the integrity of one's sick self. Since it had become outmoded, our monolithic view of communism was part of our national sick self, no longer adaptive and realistic. The issue ceased to be what was right for Vietnam and became an issue of our infallibility and preserving our national honor. Strangely enough, on a certain level, President Johnson and the men of his administration must have known what they were doing was evil. Otherwise, why all the lie? But it would be a mistake and a potentially evil rationalization itself for us to blame the evil of those days entirely on the Johnson administration. We must ask why Johnson was successful in defrauding us. Why were most of us not aroused to ire or suspicion or even significant concern about the nature of the war? Once again, we are confronted with our all-too-human laziness and narcissism. Basically, it was just too much trouble. We all had our lives to lead, doing our day-to-day jobs, buying new cars, painting our houses, sending our kids to college. As the majority of members of any group are content to let the leadership be exercised by the few, so as a citizenry, we were content to let the government do its thing. By allowing ourselves to be easily and blatantly defrauded, we as a whole people participated in the evil of the Johnson administration. The evil, the years of lying and manipulation of the Johnson administration, was directly conducive to the whole atmosphere of lying and manipulation and evil that pervaded our presence in Vietnam during those years. It was in this atmosphere that My Lai occurred in March 1968. Task Force Barker was hardly even aware that it had run amok that day. But then America was not significantly aware either in early 1968 that it too had almost unredeemably lost its bearings. Group evil is not just something that happened one morning in 1968 on the other side of the world. It is still happening all over the globe. It is happening here today. Like individual evil, group evil is common. In fact, it is more common. So common, indeed, it may be the norm. I began this discussion by noting how responsibility becomes diffused within groups, so much so that in larger groups it may become non-existent. Consider the large corporation. Even the president or chairman of the board will say, "My actions may not seem entirely ethical, but after all, they're not really a matter of my prerogative. I must be responsive to the stockholders, you know. On their account, I cannot help but be directed by the profit motive." Who is it, then, that determines the corporation's behavior? The small investor, who does not even begin to understand the operations involved? The mutual fund on the other side of the nation? Which mutual fund? Which brokerage house? Which bank? We are living in the age of the institution. So, as they become larger and larger, our institutions become absolutely faceless, soulless. What happens when there is no soul? Is there just a vacuum? Or is there Satan, where once, long ago, a soul resided? I do not know, but I think that the anti-war activists, the Berrigan brothers, are correct when they say that the task before us is nothing less than to metaphorically exorcise our institutions. There is no word adequate to describe the urgency of this task. The military-industrial complex that played such a large role in Vietnam and continues to be a primary creator of the grotesqueness of the arms race is submitted to nothing but the profit motive. This is not submission at all. It is pure self-interest. I am not an enemy of capitalism per se. I believe it is possible for the profit motive to be operative and at the same time submitted to higher values of truth and love. Difficult, but possible. If we cannot somehow engineer this submission and, quote, Christianize, unquote, our capitalism, we are doomed as a capitalist society. The total failure of submission is always evil, for a group, for an institution, for a society, as for an individual. Unless we can heal ourselves by submission, the forces of death will win the day, and we will consume ourselves in our own evil. Our study of My Lai revealed the operation of gross intellectual laziness and pathological narcissism at every level. The task of preventing group evil, including war itself, is clearly the task of eradicating, or at least significantly diminishing, laziness and narcissism. The effort to prevent group evil, including war, is, of course, a process of education. This book was written in the hope that someday all children will be carefully taught that laziness and narcissism are at the very root of all human evil, and why this is so. They will come to know that the natural tendency of the individual in a group is to forfeit his or her ethical judgment to the leader, and that this tendency should be resisted. And they will finally see it as each individual's responsibility to continually examine himself or herself for laziness and narcissism, and then to purify themselves accordingly. They will do this in the knowledge that such personal purification is required not only for the salvation of their individual soul, but also for the salvation of the world. There are a variety of reasons we have not yet developed a psychology of evil, but perhaps the most important reason is the fear of the consequences. We have good reason to be afraid. There are real dangers inherent in the development of a psychology of evil. Anyone who seeks to participate in the endeavor of subjecting the phenomenon of evil to the scrutiny of science should begin by deeply considering that this endeavor in itself has potential for causing evil. Evil is a moral judgment. I am proposing that it may also be a scientific judgment, but making the judgment scientifically will not remove it from the moral sphere. The word is pejorative. Whether we call a man evil on the basis of pure opinion or on the basis of a standardized psychological test, we are passing a moral judgment. Shouldn't we refrain from doing either? Science is dangerous enough. Moral judgment is danger enough. How dare we mix the two? In the light of Jesus' admonition, judge not that ye be not judged. If we examine the matter more closely, however, we will see that it is both impossible and itself evil to totally refrain from making moral judgments. An attitude of I'm okay, you're okay may have a certain place in facilitating our social relationships, but only a place. Let us look at everyday life. What kind of father would I be if I discovered my son cheating, lying, or stealing, and failed to criticize him? What should I tell a friend who is planning suicide, or a patient who is selling heroin? You're okay? There is such a thing as an excess of sympathy, an excess of tolerance, an excess of permissiveness. The fact of the matter is that we cannot lead decent lives without making judgments in general and moral judgments in particular. We must also remember the purpose for which we judge. If it is to heal, fine. If it is to enhance our own self-esteem, our pride, then the purpose is wrong. There but for the grace of God go I is a reflection that should accompany every judgment of another's evil. While we may never ultimately discern the meaning of human existence, including just why this person is good and the other evil, it still remains our responsibility to live as best we can, which also means to go on making the moral judgments necessary to support life. The issue, then, is not whether to judge. We must. The question is how and when to judge wisely. Our great spiritual leaders have given us the basics. But since in the end we must make moral judgments, it makes sense to further refine our wisdom with the application of scientific method and knowledge of evil when appropriate, as long as we remember the basics.
So what are everybody's thoughts on that? Just some different things that stood out to you, anything at all?
One thing to me is that it happened so many other times since then that we know of. I was watching a show on television, Black Earth Rising. It was about Rwanda and the massacre there some years ago, as you recall. Two groups, Hutsis and the Tutsis. Two minority groups went to war, and tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, were massacred in the course of a day or just a couple of days. And of course, in the show, they were looking for people that were specifically the instigators of this massacre. But it turned out that the main instigator was just an old man that he could hardly remember it anymore. And who do you blame then? It was a force bigger than any one person or any few people, almost a force that was contagious. And what I'm wondering in is if, say, anybody here has ever experienced anything like that personally.
I think that being in a unit, you have being in a group, like he's talking about group evil, you have there is a peer pressure to do what the group is saying and what the group believes and to go along with that. You know, I mean, it can be something as simple as, you know, you try to be a good, you know, a lot of people try to be a good Christian or whatever it is. But then, you know, when they go to work and somebody's making jokes that they shouldn't participate in or doing something or, you know, whatever that is, that it's just easy to keep your mouth shut or even go along with it. Or if you're feeling like you know, want to be approved of, to even be an instigator of that. You know, let alone what he was talking about in the military and they're, you know, openly promoting you to do these things, to think this way. I mean, one of the things that stood out to me in joining when I was still in high school, there was a day once I was already going to the Marine Corps and had taken the tests and had signed the papers, there was a day where you could go with a bunch of other high schoolers and you could go on a run, like you were going to go on in the Marines, and, you know, kind of get used to that and see what it was going to be like or whatever. And this program they were doing. And I was just, so we get there and they,
we will continue this discussion next episode.